Welcome once again to Radio In Vivo, your link to the Triangle Science community here on WCOM LP Chapel Hill in Carrboro. This is Ernie Hood. I am a freelance science writer, and each week here on the show we bring you cutting-edge information about what's going on in science here in the Triangle area, one of the world's leading hubs of scientific research and development. We welcome your comments or questions via email at radioinvivo@earthlink.net. And we do have a website for the program, which you can find at radioinvivo.net. You can access all of our past programs on the website. And after a little more than a year and a half of doing the show, there is now 60 hours of programming available. So anything scientific you might be interested in, you'll probably find something there. And we got more coming all the time, so we hope you'll check it out. And Radio In Vivo is also available as a podcast on iTunes. All you have to do is go to the iTunes site, search Radio In Vivo, and you'll get right to the podcast site. And, of course, we've always had podcasts available on the station's website as well. And the station's website is communityradio.coop. Radio In Vivo is underwritten by the Hamner Centers for Health Sciences in Research Triangle Park. The Hamner is a renowned leader in environmental health sciences research and education. For more than 25 years, the Hamner has contributed science that guides sound regulatory decisions and protects the health of the public. WCOM and Radio In Vivo thank the Hamner for its support. And Radio In Vivo is also underwritten by the National Evolutionary Synthesis Center in Durham. NESENT is a collaborative effort of Duke University, the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill, and North Carolina State University, and is sponsored by the National Science Foundation. NESENT's mission is to facilitate broadly synthetic research to address fundamental questions in evolutionary biology by providing an environment for fertile interactions among scientists. Radio In Vivo and WCOM thank NESENT for its support. And last but not least, Radio In Vivo is also underwritten by the North Carolina Association for Biomedical Research. Since it was founded in 1989, the NCABR has been fulfilling its mission to promote public understanding and support for bioscience research and careers. To learn more about the benefits of bioscience for the future of North Carolina, visit NCABR's homepage, www.ncabr.org, and they also have a clearinghouse of bioscience resources, www.aboutbioscience.org. WCOM and Radio In Vivo thank the North Carolina Association for Biomedical Research for its support. Well, my guest on Radio In Vivo this week is Dr. Ann Williams, and is Field Studies Coordinator for the Environmental Protection Agency's Human Studies Division, which is actually based on the UNC Chapel Hill campus. She is also President-Elect of Sigma Xi, the Scientific Research Society, and will assume those duties in July 2008. She has an academically ecumenical background with an undergraduate degree from the University of South Carolina, a master's from Duke, and a PhD in zoology from UNC Chapel Hill, and is also past president of the North Carolina Academy of Sciences. And welcome to Radio In Vivo.
Well, thank you very much for having me today, Ernie.
Anne, in reading over your CV, you've had a very diverse career. you've been in teaching and in marine biology research, and even spent some time as the project director for the Carolina Mammography Registry at UNC. And now, of course, you've been at EPA, I see, since 2002. Is there a common thread that runs through all of those experiences?
Well, I think probably an interest in environmental sciences and ecology runs through it all. As you mentioned, I taught high school for about 7 years as a biology teacher in Columbia, South Carolina. Mm-hmm. Following that, I went back to graduate school to receive my PhD and was did my research in marine ecology in Jamaica. I studied a coral reef population there.
That sounds like a long vacation.
Well, it's a long way from home, actually. It's a wonderful place. And unfortunately, the reefs there have been devastated by hurricanes and the loss of, in fact, one of the species that I studied because of an infection. Mm-hmm. But following that research, I was the head of the marine biology program at Auburn for 10 years at Auburn University in Alabama. And after being away from North Carolina, my husband is a native North Carolinian for close to 13 years, we kept saying, gee, if we could just go home to Chapel Hill. So we were able to identify a couple of jobs here. My husband works for the State Health Department. I came back as an administrator for Sigma Xi, the Scientific Research Society. Mm-hmm. And then after about 9 years of doing that, I really felt a need to go back into science.
Sure.
So was able to locate a position in a more public health-oriented program with the Carolina Mammography Registry. Took some additional training in epidemiology and public health. And then this fantastic position opened up that was able to allow me to utilize sort of my broad background. Trained as an ecologist, training in epidemiology. I am a field biologist, which means that usually during my research I was either underwater scuba diving or standing in a salt marsh somewhere. Now I'm out in the field, which means Detroit, Michigan, interviewing people about their respiratory health. So it's a field program where we do epidemiological research, which is fairly similar, just different types of animal populations.
Right.
And it involves, all of this involves my interest in, ongoing interest in environmental sciences and ecology.
So this position has really brought everything together.
Absolutely.
And you're not stuck behind a desk.
Well, I am stuck behind a desk a lot of the time.
Okay.
But there are opportunities for us to go out in the field. And during the summertime, for the past, I would say, 4 years, we have been involved, people in my branch, with a study which we affectionately call the Beaches Program, but it's actually the National Environmental, NEEAR, National Environmental and Ecological Assessment of Recreational Water Studies.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
What we're doing is going into public beaches, both in the Great Lakes and marine waters. We've been to Biloxi, Mississippi, just before Katrina. This summer we've been in Fairhope, Alabama. We're also in West Warwick, Rhode Island, interviewing beachgoers and taking water samples. And we ask people about their health over the past 2 weeks before they have gone to the beach, some demographic information, and after they leave the beach, or when they leave the beach, we ask them questions about what they've done during the day. Did they swim? Did they swallow water?
Mm-hmm.
How much exposure did they have to the sun and the sand? And 2 weeks following that, we call them back up and say, you know, how was your health? You been sick to your stomach? Have you had any gastrointestinal discomfort, any respiratory problems, any skin problems? Now, we've known for eons that people who are exposed to poor water quality do have health issues. And that's part of our study. We also take water samples at the same time.
Sure.
But we're looking to develop and to validate some new indicators of water quality. Over the past 30 years since EPA has been in existence, we've developed standards that are based on the growth of bacteria, not pathogenic, but indicator bacteria, on auger plates,
mm-hmm.
so that we can then visibly count these to give us, you know, a limited number of samples from which we can determine whether the water quality was good or bad.
Sure.
Unfortunately, that sort of study takes 24 to 48 hours to develop. So if you were to go to the beach today, I could tell you what the water quality was 2 days ago,
right,
based on sampling.
So not terribly actionable.
No, not right. And not protective of the public health.
Right. Mm-hmm.
So what we're doing today is to validate several different rapid indicators based on DNA testing, which can give us a result in 2 hours. So we can go out and test the water at 8 o'clock in the morning, and by 10 o'clock we can determine whether or not it's suitable for the public to go swimming.
All right. Well, that's terrific, and I want to ask you quite a bit more about that study.
Okay.
That is called the NEAR study?
The NEAR Water Study.
National Epidemiological and Environmental Assessment of Recreational Water.
Thank you for getting that correct. Sometimes I get a bit confused on all the acronyms.
I can't imagine with all the acronyms in the federal government. How long has the NEAR study been going on, Ann?
It's actually been going on since 2002. A pilot study was done in 2002. And then for the past 4 to 5 years, we have gone to different beaches. We spent 2 summers, I believe, in the Great Lakes looking at water beaches in Indiana, Michigan, Illinois. Mm-hmm. We then went, as I mentioned, to Biloxi, Mississippi, and this summer we have 2 additional beaches. This will go on for several more years.
I see. So both freshwater and saltwater,
and marine.
Then?
Mm-hmm.
I see. And have you seen a difference between the two in terms of the fluctuations in water quality?
Well, we always look for beaches that are sort of average. You know, we want to find beaches that are representative of the beach population, if you would call it a population. We also look for beaches that have a water point source. That is a source where the treated water is pumped into the recreational water at some near position. And so the beaches tend to be fairly similar. The Great Lakes beaches have tended to be fairly similar. I can't tell you much about the marine beaches as yet because last year, or I should say 2 years ago, was the first marine beach that we did in Biloxi. Mm-hmm. Unfortunately, Hurricane Katrina interfered with some of our results.
As with so much science.
That's right. Well, unfortunately, we lost a lot of data because the storm ravaged Gulfport, which is where we were Gulfport, Biloxi, where we were located.
Sure.
And so we lost the contact with the people who we had interviewed prior to that.
Indeed. How far out do you follow up with the cohort of people that you are able to recruit?
We follow them 10 days to 2 weeks after their exposure.
I see.
And it's just that single contact.
I see. And how many beachgoers do you typically talk to when you're out there?
Well, that's a very good question. It depends on the number of goers to the beach.
Okay.
It depends on the weather.
Right.
It depends on whether or not there is a fee charged. Our least populated beaches, actually, Biloxi probably had a fairly low population, but I'd say anywhere between, we're looking for beaches that provide us with 50 to 100 individuals per day. And we do these only on weekends and on holidays. So we'll be every Friday and Saturday, usually from Memorial Day weekend through Labor Day, with additional days for the holidays for the 4th of July and for Labor Day weekend and so, Memorial Day weekend.
So all the holidays and summer weekends are working times for
That's
you folks.
That's true. My colleagues in the epidemiology and biomarkers branch all volunteer their weekends. So we sort of rotate. We have 1 to 2 members from the branch on site. Mm-hmm. We work with a group of contractors that are provided by Westat Incorporated. So they're actually gathering the data. We don't have sufficient person power within the branch to do all of the interviewing.
So will the examination of a particular beach go on for, say, an entire summer season?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. So you will actually end up with quite
thousands
a bit of data.
Thousands of data points, yes.
Yeah.
Because we interview only adults, only people over 18, but we ask them about all of the family members with them at the beach that day and get information about the health of all of those, and then also any family members who are at home and not attending the beach. So we have a good sort of representative people who have been exposed and those who have not been exposed. We also take their location through GPS on the beach so we know how close they were to the water.
Wow.
And as I said, we ask questions about whether they swallowed water, whether they ate any food during the day. So we get a lot of information. And I guess the other thing that's interesting about this is that we use what's called a CAPI device, a computer-assisted personal interviewing system. So the questionnaire is on a small tablet computer.
Okay.
And the interviewers then only have to sort of stroke through the various questions. It's very efficient, uses less paper, so we're trying to keep up with the paper limitation uses of the government.
Oh, that's a good thing.
Yeah.
Certainly.
Mm-hmm.
So what have been some of the results that you've seen with some of this data? Are you able to correlate the data that's being gathered with people becoming ill and with the water quality that day?
Absolutely. We usually use a sort of a risk ratio, and there is an increased risk for gastroenteritis on days when the water quality has been elevated. Mm-hmm. This is usually associated not necessarily with a failure of the water system, but it's often associated with rainfall events where there will be greater runoff. So it doesn't necessarily mean that the local water purification system has failed, mm-hmm. but there's a good bit of runoff from the shores during water events, and that generally leads to an increase in or a decrease in water quality.
Right, and an increase in illness.
In illness, right.
I see. Mm-hmm. So these locations are typically, as you mentioned, just to clarify, beaches that are close to
water purification plants.
Where mm-hmm. treated water is being
released.
Sent out.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
So are those typically where the problems arise?
Most often, yes. That is the problem. As I mentioned, usually following rainfall events, there may be a problem. Occasionally, we do know that sometimes even the water purification plants get overloaded with extreme water rainfall events. And so at that time, then the water quality may decline extremely because there may be untreated water flowing into the recreational area.
Right. And at that point, that's time to close the beach.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. And the states do manage that. Mm-hmm. EPA sets the standards for the country, but the states and the local health departments and tribal groups establish their own water quality standards and do the monitoring.
So, Anne, how big a problem has this been in the past? Has contaminated recreational water been a serious health problem in various places?
Well, it has been. I can't provide you with any data right now, but
sure.
On occasion it has been.
Mm-hmm. What types of illnesses do people complain of when they have had this type of exposure?
Well, it depends, of course, on the type of contamination. One of the organisms that's often found in the water, which is not monitored, except under very up-to-date, technically modern water systems, is Cryptosporidium. Mm-hmm. And that's a protozoan that causes extreme explosive diarrhea. So we see a lot of diarrhea, some nausea, vomiting. But in addition to that, there are skin rashes, and if you inhale water, you can get a respiratory infection as well. Those are the typical ones.
I see. So is the route of exposure when people get sick after swimming in contaminated water like this, is it mainly through the skin, or have you found that most people have swallowed?
It's mostly a swallowing of water.
I see. And when you interview these folks, is it mainly the kids that end up swallowing some water, or does it seem to span across?
Well, that's interesting. It depends on how much swimming they do. Children do tend to swallow small amounts of water.
Mm-hmm.
People who are exercising or boating, for instance, on a windsurfer, might also swallow water. And so we try to track individuals' activities. We ask if they've been swimming, if they had their head below the surface of the water, in addition to whether or not they think they've swallowed water.
I see. Now, you've probably been out on the beach and conducted some of these interviews yourself on occasion. Are people cooperative? Are they intrigued?
They are generally very cooperative. We track refusal rates of people who are just not interested. Mm-hmm. And generally the refusal rates are below, I would say, 15%, usually much lower than that. Mm-hmm. We do provide some incentives, of course. People leaving the beach will receive a small folding cooler or a beach bag.
Oh, neat.
And then after we call them up, we will send them a $25 check in the mail for their participation.
I see. Well, next time I'm at the beach, I'm going to watch for...
look for our EPA tents.
EPA person with a tablet roaming around. That sounds pretty neat. Well, let's go back and talk about the rapid measurement technology, because that's really the bottom line of what we're all about here. You mentioned that the previous or the existing technology, it takes about 24 hours to assess the water quality.
Mm-hmm.
But this does it in two, roughly.
That's right, in two hours.
How does it work? What's it
all
about?
Well, I can't give you all the details because I'm not a biochemist.
No, that's okay.
But it is a PCR technology. What it does is to multiply the DNA that's found in the bacteria. It breaks the cells of the bacteria, Enterococcus and E. coli, multiplies that DNA, and then it's easily evaluated following that. So it's a very new technology, and we're testing actually several different systems, but basically all of them using the DNA technology.
So it's the same technology that's used for genomic studies and things like that.
Mm-hmm. And one of the interesting things, I think, is that when you do the old growing the bacteria on the agriculture, the only thing you're accounting for are actually viable cells in the water.
Mm-hmm.
Under the new PCR, if there have been cells in the water, which maybe were there a couple of hours ago but are dead now, their DNA, if it's not decomposed, can be accounted for. So I think it gives you a more accurate estimate of the number of bacteria that are present in the water column.
I see. Would the dead bacteria still be very virulent?
It's hard to say.
Okay.
We haven't actually looked at that issue, but we think it is a more accurate estimate.
So where does the analysis itself take place? Has this been technology been modularized so that it can be right there at the beach house?
Well, that's what we like. We like this sort of dipstick technology that we can expose a small instrument, perhaps, to the water on the beach.
Mm-hmm.
We're not at that point as yet.
I see.
Presently, we have to take our water samples. We take water samples 3 times a day, at 8 o'clock, 11 o'clock, and at 3 o'clock.
Mm-hmm.
And these are put on ice, and they're taken to a nearby laboratory. So the process is actually done in a laboratory fairly close to the beach site.
I see. But eventually, the idea is to have that beach manager be able to do it themselves.
Absolutely.
Right there on site.
Absolutely.
And make their decisions about what to do, if anything.
That's right.
Quickly.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And that's ultimately what's going to improve protection of public health.
That's
right?
Exactly right.
Okay. My guest on Radio In Vivo today is Dr. Ann Williams, who is the Field Studies Coordinator for the EPA's Human Studies Division. And she is also President-Elect of Sigma Xi, the Scientific Research Society. Ann, how long is this particular study projected to continue?
I think we're probably going to see it extending at least through 2010.
Mm-hmm.
I know that we will be visiting 2, possibly 3 beaches next summer. And then I'm not sure about the funding possibilities beyond that time, but it will take several years beyond that, of course, to finish analyzing all of the data. And we may have another beach summer following that.
I see. Any chance you're coming to North Carolina? Should we be looking for you down at Emerald Isle or anything?
Well, we have considered beaches in North Carolina, but we don't have the point sources along the North Carolina beaches that we really need to look for to examine.
I see. Well, we certainly haven't seen, at least under my impression, correct me if I'm wrong, our beaches, you know, being subject to these closings
exactly.
because of contamination. It seems much more concentrated in the Northeast.
The Northeast, the Gulf of Mexico, Great Lakes beaches, some in California as well. We've considered going to some of the beaches in Southern California, There are some point sources that are just south of the border in Mexico that may be problematic for the Southern California beaches. So we may be going out there at some time in the future.
I see. So this is certainly a technology that, once it's perfected, I would think could be applied anywhere in the world.
Absolutely.
And I'm sure there are a lot of places where the sewage treatment standards are not the same as ours.
Right.
So is this a worldwide public health issue?
I believe so. We tend to focus, of course, our attention on the United States, but certainly water quality is an issue worldwide, both drinking water and recreational water.
Mm-hmm.
Water is probably going to prove to be our most important limiting resource for the world populations.
Sure. Does this technology have any application on the drinking water side of things?
Absolutely. In testing within the water quality treatment plants themselves, this technology could be certainly of use. Water quality treatment plants have to monitor their water on a daily basis, and certainly this would be available for them to use.
I see.
That's a good point.
So, but we're still looking at really several years until the translation takes
Unfortunately,
place.
Yes.
Is this something that eventually would be pitched out to a commercial developer?
Very possibly, yes. Mm-hmm. That's not something that we're concerning ourselves with at the time, but I think certainly this process might be a patentable process.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Okay, so it could potentially be a spin out at some point.
Mm-hmm.
Now, one question I would have, and I like to ask questions I already know the answer to sometimes, but, you know, putting myself at least in the mind of a potential listener, why does it take so long, Anne? Why does it take so many years? It seems like you could go out to the beach for one summer and gather your data and say, yes, this technology is a vast improvement. What takes so long to get to the endpoints?
Well, one sample is never sufficient. You really do have to have a large sample for the data to be statistically valid. And in our first three summers, we were looking at freshwater beaches, and now we've just made the move 2 years ago to marine beaches. And that's a very different ballgame.
Mm-hmm.
Same organisms, but different standards for marine and freshwater.
I see. Well, that makes perfect sense. What organisms are you looking at?
Well, we often look at E. coli, which is a common bacterium found in our own GI system. So if it's present in the water, then there's evidence that there is fecal contamination of some type.
Mm-hmm.
Although it's not a pathogen, there are a few strains that can be very problematic, but the normal flora is
not. If you get it in your hamburger, you're in trouble.
That's right. But the normal flora, of course, is not a problem.
Sure.
And Enterococcus is another common indicator species. Again,
it's not a pathogen, is it not?
No, it is not a pathogen. So, and then this third one is called Bacteroides, and none of those are pathogens. We aren't looking for bacterial pathogens. These are just common waterborne bacteria.
So what are the pathogens of concern here?
Well, the pathogens, many of them are viruses. Many of them are protozoans such as Endomoeba histolytica, Cryptosporidium.
Mm-hmm.
Those are things that we are very, very concerned about.
And Cryptosporidium, that's the one that's caused some
severe problems. That's right.
Through the years.
Mm-hmm.
So the technology, the detection of the levels of the non-pathogenic species, that is an indicator that
it's
you
an
can
indicator.
Be pretty sure you've got a problem with the pathogens.
That's right. It's what we call a surrogate.
I see.
So we're not...
Are they easier to
detect?
They
are much easier to grow and to detect.
I see.
So it's very difficult to isolate Cryptosporidium. It's a very complicated flotation process. They're very small spores.
Mm-hmm.
And they don't grow in media as bacteria do.
Okay.
These pathogens also are not very susceptible to being killed by chlorine, by chlorination processes. So that's why we're always very, very concerned about those. And again, cryptosporidium is an exposure that most of us get as children. They're carried by dogs and cats and horses and cows. So almost all of us are exposed at an early age, and we develop an immunity. Mm-hmm. The problem is primarily for susceptible populations, young children, older people, and those with immune compromised systems can actually die of severe cryptosporidium infections.
I see. And that can come as a result of
exposure to contaminated water, primarily.
Well, certainly anything we can do to prevent that is going to be a good thing.
Absolutely.
I came across an interesting study recently that I'd like to get your comment on. I'm sure you probably saw it. Researchers at the Johns Hopkins Bloomberg School of Public Health found that the levels of potentially harmful waterborne microorganisms, I think including some of the ones you've been discussing, may actually be highest when the water is most crowded with swimmers.
Oh.
Theoretically due to swimmers stirring up all these little pathogens resting in the sediment. Have you folks found anything like that, or has that not been something you've actively looked at?
Well, that's an interesting issue. It's true that water quality declines when there is a lot of sediment in the water column, and so we look that's one of the indicators that we look at. That, in other words, how clear is the water? Whether or not that the bacteria are stirred up into the water, or whether, in fact, large crowds of people contribute to the contamination of the water through their own bodily functions is an issue that we haven't determined as yet.
Well, you know, we all know that goes on.
Unfortunately. We always ask whether small children are in diapers and whether those children have been in the water. But that's probably a very minor contribution to water quality.
Let's hope so.
Right.
And I hope people aren't tossing their Pampers into the water either.
Exactly.
Well, that brings up a point. Is part of your data collection, you say that you always want to be near, look at a beach near a point source, because that seems to be where these problems tend to arise. Are you also collecting data from the treatment facilities themselves to correlate in?
No, we're not, but we are collecting water along the beach,
okay.
And we know where the point source is located. So we can do sort of a spectrum of samples from near the point source to a distance away. So that gives us a relationship, a possible correlation between water, contaminated water going into the beach and the source.
I see.
We have to be aware of current flow and wind direction and all of those other environmental factors as well.
Sure.
Rainfall.
Mm-hmm. And is all that other, all that type
all
of data
that is being,
all
is,
being collected?
Absolutely. Mm-hmm.
Goodness, there's a lot of data being pulled in out at the beach.
There certainly is. Data analysis following a study is often much more time and work and effort than actually the data collection.
Sure.
But it's also kind of a fun part. Those of us who work in epidemiological and ecological work really enjoy sort of playing with the numbers and looking at the statistics.
And that's where the new knowledge is going to emerge,
that's
right?
That's right.
Have there been any publications from this, from the NEAR study yet?
We've had several publications. I can't give you the citations. I wish I thought
okay.
to bring them.
No, not
One in Environmental Health Perspectives, I believe, last year. We've had several poster presentations and platform presentations on the work.
I see. Well, if there's an article in EHP, that being open access,
right.
I will make a link to it after the fact here.
Absolutely.
That'll go with the archival version
well,
of
good.
The program.
Good. I believe the first author is Tim Wade. He's the PI on the study. So
I see. Okay.
You can look for his name.
Tim Wade. Great. Mm-hmm. And that was last year?
I think so. Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Either last year or late the previous year.
I'd like to ask a little bit broader about some of the things that you're up to. I'd like to hear more about the Human Studies Division itself.
Mm-hmm.
It's part of the epidemiology and biomarkers branch.
Well, the epidemiology and biomarkers branch is a branch within the Human Studies Division.
Oh, I see.
Right. Okay. There are two branches in our division, and we're the only division of NHERL, National Health and Environmental Exposure Research Laboratory, mm-hmm. that's not located in our new facility out at RTP.
Right. And why is that?
Well, it's because our division, Human Studies Division, has a cooperative agreement with the University of North Carolina. So we share a building on the UNC campus. Mm-hmm. If you've ever been to the Ambulatory Care Center, the ACC, you will have seen our building. We're on Mason Farm Road. Five stories are occupied by EPA and four floors. And one floor is occupied by the Center for Environmental Medicine and Asthma Lung Biology, which is a center of UNC practitioners and scientists. We cooperate on the use of a medical station that we have in the facility. And we have state-of-the-art exposure chambers in the facility where we can expose human volunteers to known quantities of ozone, for instance, or diesel fuel exhaust.
Mm-hmm.
Following an individual's exposure, we ask them sometimes to exercise while they're in these chambers. They can ride bicycles or walk on treadmills. We then have the facilities at the medical station to actually measure biomarkers. So we'll measure their heart rate. We will do a bronchoscopy to look at changes in the lung tissue, mm-hmm. Measure bodily fluids.
And pulmonary function.
Pulmonary function, right. Mm-hmm. So the CMALB group works in conjunction with our clinical research branch, which is the second branch in our division. They work very closely together, although my branch also works with CMALB on occasion on different studies.
I see.
So it's a very unique unit. And it is convenient to have volunteers come to the UNC campus, many of them coming to the UNC hospital, to our facility, rather than having to go all the way out to RTP. So
That's
a long answer to your question about why are we not located out there.
That's a very good answer. A lot of good reasons, it sounds like.
Mm-hmm.
It sounds like there's just a wealth of high-tech equipment. I would imagine that the exposure chambers, for example, are not something you find commonly.
That's right. There are groups of exposure chambers around the country, but we like to think of ours as a very important resource of the agency.
Mm-hmm.
And the work coming from those chambers is extremely interesting and extremely important in terms of human health.
Sure.
At the current moment, you might be curious about the diesel exhaust.
Absolutely.
We actually have a diesel engine truck located outside of our facility, and it produces a known amount of diesel exhaust, which is piped directly into the chambers to expose volunteers to.
Oh, that sounds kind of scary.
It is kind of scary, I think.
Is it Uncle Joe's old truck parked out at the corner?
No, I can't tell you exactly what the specifications on the truck are. I mean, it's just that I don't know them. But
sure.
It's a panel truck.
I see.
And it has sort of a standard exhaust that is used so that we know that each time a subject is exposed, they're receiving the same exposure.
Now, when these exposure studies are done, are people receiving, I guess what they call environmentally relevant doses,
yes.
The same kind of dose if you were
walking
the street corner,
right.
Or possibly driving in a car behind a source like that?
Right. That's what we're trying to do, is to create an environment where we can actually measure the exposure, and the exposure is a realistic exposure.
Mm-hmm. And what types of particles? I know that you're also able to generate particles in these chambers.
Right.
Are you looking at the the big ones, the small ones, or the so-called ultrafines?
We have done both large particulate matter and small particulate matter, but again, there's a standard that is used for the particulate matter. Mm-hmm. We also have environmental monitoring on a daily 24-hour basis on the roof of our facility that constantly monitors particulate matter in the air and ozone levels.
I see. Well, I know that the standards for those various levels of particulate matter are an ongoing subject of controversy.
They are.
So these studies must be pretty influential in terms of potential policy and regulation, I would imagine.
They are, and that is the function of NHRL. We do the science, mm-hmm. Gather the exposure data and the health data, which is used as a basis for the regulatory standards of the other part of our agency. I'm within the Office of Research and Development. We do not set standards, but we do the science on which the standards are based.
I see. And have you been able to see an impact? I guess you've been there, 5 years now?
Only 5 years.
Have you ever been able to see an impact from, okay, here's the study we've done, and, 3, 4, 5 years down the road, standards are adjusted?
Well, I think it takes a little longer than that, unfortunately.
These days, at least.
Right.
Maybe
but
we'll accelerate that soon.
Right. I do know that the Office of Water is working right now on the recreational water standards based on the studies that we're doing. So,
I see. So the water studies could actually have an impact on standards and regulation.
Absolutely.
And policy.
Mm-hmm.
Well, that's exciting.
Mm-hmm. And I should also say that I'm fairly certain, of course, this was before my tenure at EPA, but I believe the ozone standards were based primarily on the work that was done in our environmental chambers.
Is that right?
Mm-hmm.
No, that's got to be pretty rewarding.
Absolutely.
And, to see that you are, in fact, having an impact and truly protecting public health.
Mm-hmm.
Anne, I wanted to ask you about, you mentioned that you've spent a lot of time in Detroit in the last few years, and would like to just get a flavor for some of the other studies that go on in the Human Studies Division, perhaps the best example being the one you've been involved with,
mm-hmm.
Which is the Detroit Children's Health Study.
Mm-hmm.
Can you tell us about that?
The Detroit Children's Health Study was the main study, but I should say that there are two additional companion studies that occurred simultaneously with the Detroit Children's Health Study. We also had the Mechanistic Indicators of Childhood Asthma Study,
mm-hmm.
Or MICA, and then a home air quality study that was done to measure the air quality within and without homes of some of the people who participated in the study. And then the National Exposure Research Laboratory, NERL, also conducted and has an ongoing study on air quality in the Detroit, Dearborn, Michigan area. This is our studies, Detroit Children's Health Study and MICA and the Home Air Study, have been planned since about 2003. We've been working on these. We finally finished our data collection in January of this year.
Mm-hmm.
So it's been a long-term process.
Sure. How large has the cohort been?
Well, the cohort, we originally sent out almost 7,000 questionnaires to the parents of children who were patients at the Henry Ford Health System in Detroit, pediatric patients.
Mm-hmm.
Their parents filled out a 20-page questionnaire, and we received back almost 1,200 health questionnaires. These health questionnaires provided us with demographic information about the family, past history of any respiratory problems such as asthma, wheezing, any other health problems, the home environment, whether or not the parents were smokers or non-smokers, generally how much time the child spent outdoors, what type of vehicle they rode into school, all sorts of information.
Sure.
from the returns, from the 1,200 returns, we recruited 700 children to then come in for follow-up respiratory health measures, where we used spirometers to measure their lung function. We measured a new measure of exhaled nitric oxide in their breath. Nitric oxide is produced by the body when there is an inflammation, in particular in the lungs. So to actually get a good measure of their health on a particular day when they came to the clinic. In addition to that, 200 of these children were recruited for a slightly more invasive health diagnostics, where we took blood samples, urine samples, nail clippings. We did an odor test because there are some indication that odor detection by children is a measure of developmental processes.
I see.
What else? It was a huge battery. So
they didn't do the bronchial lavage.
No, we didn't. But 100 of these children were asthmatics, and 100 were not. So we have a good comparison there for all of these statistics, as a comparison between healthy children and asthmatic children.
So what is the ultimate goal of the study?
Well, what we're looking for there, we're looking for correlations with the external air sources and their exposure. We're particularly interested with their home environment and how close it is to roadways, because we feel that there's a correlation between closeness to roadways and perhaps respiratory problems.
Mm-hmm. There's already been a lot of data that indicates
exactly. There have been a number of studies, both in this country and in Europe, indicating that. Right. Our population is children between the ages of 7 and 12 years old, so I think we're focusing more on those children in the susceptible populations.
Sure.
The children who gave the biomarkers were slightly older, between 9 and 12 years old. We were a little hesitant about drawing blood on extremely young children.
Right.
So we're looking for, in the MICA study, immunological biomarkers that can be correlated with both respiratory health and with environmental exposure.
Well, that's certainly one of the fascinating aspects of that study. I understand that it's being used to assess new risk assessment methods that go beyond traditional toxicology and more into a systems biology or computational toxicology.
Right. The MICA study was funded by the Computational Toxicology Center, which is a new center at EPA in the NHERL laboratory.
So how do these new methods differ from the previous ones?
Well, we haven't really been able up until this point to establish exactly how the body responds to stressors from the environment.
Mm-hmm.
So we're looking at ways of being able to predict whether individuals are going to respond, so that we can perhaps identify individuals that need protection, and also to set standards that will go a bit further to protecting these susceptible populations.
Right. So one of the outcomes that may emerge from this huge study, and I know there are other similar ones going on as well, might be an impact on standards.
Absolutely.
At some point.
Absolutely.
Would that be ozone or particulate matter or just
all of the above? All of the above. There's a big new mission within the agency to look at multiple factors affecting individuals.
Mm-hmm.
Instead of looking at just a particular type of compound, we're now realizing that every day you and I are exposed to a cocktail of toxicants.
Right.
And so we're trying to go down that road.
Oh, that's a very difficult road, I know.
It is a very difficult road because, as you're well aware, in science we're used to controlling and modifying a single factor at a time in an experiment. So looking at a real-life experiment with multiple factors is a very complicated process.
Absolutely. Well, that'll keep the computational people pretty busy.
Busy for a long time.
Well, because obviously if we're walking down the street or driving in a car and you know, inevitably being exposed to exhaust and whatever, that is going to be a mixture constantly and constantly changing, I would imagine.
That's right.
So you also have to take the changes over time into account for these kind of...
That's right. You have to take into account seasons, as you're probably well aware. Ozone is more of a problem in the summertime in the heat than it is in the wintertime. So seasonality certainly factors into it. It's a very complex issue.
Absolutely. Well, is the thinking behind the Detroit study and other similar ones that it may be exposure to air pollutants that is part of the reason for this explosion in asthma?
That's certainly part of our working hypothesis. Mm-hmm. We are seeing not only respiratory issues, but also cardiovascular problems.
Sure.
So there are multiple health outcomes that we are trying to take into consideration. And that's another reason for looking at biomarkers, because often we can find biomarkers that are indicative, or we're going to be looking for biomarkers that are indicative of cardiovascular issues as well as pulmonary effects.
Yeah, and there's certainly a lot of work in the cardiovascular area, not only in EPA, but in academia as
That's
well,
right.
I know.
Yeah. That's right.
Well, it'll be interesting to see how everything plays out.
It's certainly going to keep us busy for quite a few years.
It sure sounds like it. Well, if you're not, you know, laying on the beach all the time, you know, maybe we'll get some data one of these days.
Unfortunately, having spent most of my life as a marine ecologist, I get that sort of
I can imagine
prompt all the time. You're just out there on the beach.
Well, Ann, we are nearing the end of our hour, and I do not want to let the time pass without talking a little bit about Sigma Xi.
Oh, good.
You're going to be taking over as president about a year from now.
That's right.
And you used to be an employee, as you mentioned. How are you going to balance the demands of that office with your other considerable professional responsibilities, as we've just been talking about? Are you going to take a leave from EPA for a while?
No.
Or are you going to clone yourself?
Well, maybe I'll do that. It's certainly, as I have found since being president-elect effective July 1st, taking up perhaps more of my time than I anticipated.
Mm-hmm.
But one help, as far as the society is concerned and as far as I'm concerned, is that the international headquarters for Sigma Xi is located in Research Triangle Park.
Oh, they're right next door to...
That's right. Just down the road from EPA,
mm-hmm.
Or from our main laboratory at EPA.
Right. Sure.
That's good for Sigma Xi, perhaps not so good for me, because I'm the only officer located locally.
Mm-hmm.
So whenever they need someone, or they have to have some advice, or they have something that needs to be done, or you know, some sort of representation, I'm going to be the first one called upon.
Mm-hmm.
And there's probably going to be a fair amount of travel associated with this, because whenever we install a new chapter, we have more than 500 chapters in universities and laboratories and areas around the country and really globally.
Mm-hmm.
One of the officers has to go and do the installation, so I'll be involved
okay.
in some of that. Committee meetings generally will be held at Research Triangle Park. But EPA has been quite generous with me. Whenever you participate as a volunteer in a scientific organization, you're required to get advance approval for an approved outside activity, as they refer to it. So this was approved when I was a candidate for the position. It is one of my approved activities, and EPA has been very generous in allowing me to have a certain number of days of administrative leave when I need to be on travel for the society.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of our activities, as far as officers are concerned, occur on weekends, so
I see.
I'm going to be using a lot of personal time, too.
Well, I would think for EPA and for the federal government in general, it would be a great source of pride.
Well, I think they are pleased that I have been elected to this position. I know that there was an announcement about this on EPA's website. So I think they're rather happy.
And what led you to offer yourself for that position?
Well, I've been a member of Sigma Xi since 1975, and I was initiated as a graduate student at UNC. Most of our members are initiated either as undergraduates or graduate students following the conduction of a significant piece of research. We have two levels of membership. Students are generally initiated as associate members, and once they have published either two first authored publications or a dissertation and a publication, they are promoted to full membership.
Sure.
Mm-hmm. So since 1975, I've been involved. Sigma Xi provided two grants in aid of research for me to do my research in Jamaica as a graduate student. We have a wonderful program that provides small grant funds for students. So I've always felt sort of obligated to the society. Mm-hmm. I was an officer in the chapter at Auburn. I'm an officer in the UNC chapter.
Okay.
And have served on a number of committees, including the Strategic Planning Committee. I chaired the Nominations Committee. And my colleagues felt that it was time to move up, I guess.
Wonderful. It must be quite a thrill. I'm sure it's something you're really looking forward to.
It is, and I am looking forward to it very much. It's a huge responsibility to serve as an officer for our more than 60,000 members who are scientists and engineers and researchers throughout the world.
Well, we certainly wish you the best for a very successful year at the helm of Sigma Xi.
Thank you very much.
And we are just about out of time. My guest on Radio In Vivo this week has been Dr. Ann Williams with the Environmental Protection Agency and President-elect of Sigma Xi, the Scientific Research Society. Ann, we very much appreciate you coming in today and sharing all this with us.
Thank you for having me.
We have got some terrific guests, as always, lined up in the coming weeks here on Radio In Vivo. You can check out the website, radioinvivo.net, for the lineup, which is updated regularly as we book new appearances. So please join us again next time for Radio In Vivo, your link to the Triangle Science community, right here on volunteer-powered WCOM-FM, Carrboro and Chapel Hill. And if you enjoy the program, we do ask that you please make an effort to support the station by volunteering, contributing, or underwriting our programming. See you next time.